Imagine taking a daily pill to cure your depression, right? Like you diligently swallow it every single morning for a decade.
Right, which is just the reality for millions of people.
Exactly. But then imagine realizing years later that this very medication has physically and permanently locked the neurological doors in your brain.
Yeah, essentially preventing the next generation of psychiatric cures from ever actually working on you.
It is wild.
Yeah.
And that is the staggering biological paradox we are unpacking today.
It really is a profound collision of paradigms when you look closely at it.
Because, you know, we are living in a culture that is absolutely saturated with antidepressants.
Mm.
Like hundreds of millions of people rely on them just to function, you know, just to get out of bed and survive the modern world.
Yeah. And then simultaneously, you literally cannot open a browser without being assaulted by the deafening cultural hype around psychedelics.
Oh my gosh, everywhere. The narrative is just everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Magic mushrooms are going to completely rewrite human mental health.
Right. On one side of the ring, we have the most prescribed psychiatric medicines in human history. And they are backed by decades of, you know, longitudinal safety data.
Yeah, the heavyweights.
Exactly. And on the other side, we have this incredibly potent, historically stigmatized Schedule I compound. And it is currently just blasting through late stage clinical trials.
Riding this massive, almost messianic wave of public enthusiasm.
It really is. And the problem is when you look online to try and compare them or figure out which path actually makes sense, you don't find science.
No, you don't. You find two completely distinct religions just shouting past each other.
Yeah, exactly. You've got the daily pill advocates aggressively defending the biochemical status quo.
And then the psychedelic evangelists treating psilocybin like it's a magic wand that just cures all human suffering.
Right, which is just not how pharmacology works.
So today, for you listening, the mission for this deep dive is to bypass that tribal noise entirely. We're going to look at the exact grounded neuroscience and the hard clinical data comparing these two specific tools.
Yes, and our guide for this is a deeply researched article published on July 31st, 2026 in the OOTW Journal.
Right, titled Psilocybin versus SSRIs, How They Actually Compare in the Brain.
And, you know, the real value of this specific source is its ruthless demand for clinical honesty.
Yeah, it really doesn't pull any punches.
It doesn't. It forces a very sober look at what each tool is genuinely equipped to do, where the empirical evidence is robust and where the prevailing cultural hype has radically outrun the actual science.
Okay, so let's unpack this, because right out of the gate, the OOTW piece hits us with this crazy neurochemical paradox.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting.
Both of these treatments, so the standard SSRI, which is your daily antidepressant, and psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, they both target the exact same system in the human brain.
Right. They are both serotonin modulators.
So the obvious question here is, you know, how can two compounds that operate in the exact same chemical neighborhood produce such wildly, fundamentally divergent effects on human consciousness?
Well, the divergence lies in the architectural strategy they use to manipulate that serotonin.
Okay, right.
To understand how they perform against each other in a human patient, we have to isolate the microscopic mechanics first.
The actual plumbing of the brain, basically.
Exactly. So the SSRI, which stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor, it deploys a strategy of chronic accumulation.
A chronic accumulation.
Yeah.
What does that actually look like in the synapse?
Okay, so when a neuron releases serotonin to transmit a signal across the synaptic cleft, which is just the gap between neurons, a transporter protein normally sweeps in.
Right, to clean up the mess.
Yeah, the SERT pump. It sweeps in to reabsorb the leftover serotonin, clearing the space for the next signal to fire.
Like a vacuum cleaner?
Exactly, like a vacuum cleaner. But the SSRI physically wedges itself into that transporter pump, effectively blocking the vacuum.
Oh, wow. So the serotonin just has nowhere to go. It just pools up in that synaptic gap.
It floods the space completely and continuously. But the crucial mechanism of an SSRI isn't actually just the pooling of serotonin.
Wait, really? I always thought it was just about having more serotonin available.
That's the common misconception, yeah. The actual therapeutic mechanism is the brain's eventual kind of desperate adaptation to that pooling.
Okay, explain that.
Well, the brain is relentlessly homeostatic. It always wants balance. So if you bathe its receptors in a flood of serotonin for weeks on end, The brain interprets that as a massive overstimulation.
Like, whoa, this is way too loud. We need to turn this down.
Precisely. So to protect itself, it begins a slow downstream process of downregulation. It physically retracts or desensitizes specific serotonin receptors.
Mostly the 5-HT1A autoreceptors, right?
Okay.
The article mentioned those specifically.
Yes, exactly. It retracts them to reduce the overall signal intensity.
I want to translate that microscopic process into a macroscopic experience, just so we can visualize it.
Go for it.
Okay, so if I picture the depressed human brain as a physical space, like a chaotic, overwhelmingly loud sensory overload room where distress is just ricocheting off the walls.
Right, a very agonizing space to be in.
Right. The SSRI mechanism is essentially installing heavy acoustic soundproofing in that room.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah. You are slowly, over a period of weeks, layering acoustic foam over the walls. It lowers the overall gain on the room's reactivity.
Yeah, the crushing, deafening lows of depression become muffled.
Exactly. They lose their sharp edges. But, and here's the catch, because you've uniformly soundproofed the room, the highs, you know, the moments of intense joy or excitement or deep connection, they get absorbed by the foam too.
Right, because the foam doesn't know the difference between a good sound and a bad sound.
It's just a physiological strategy of steady, continuous dampening.
That captures the clinical reality perfectly. You are chemically lowering the gain on the entire limbic system.
Yeah.
It is broad, chronic dampening.
Okay, so that is the daily pill. Now, psilocybin is operating in that same serotonin system, right?
Yes. But it executes a completely different blueprint, like totally different.
So how does the mushroom approach the serotonin system?
Well, when psilocybin enters the body, it is metabolized into psilocin. And psilocin doesn't bother blocking reuptake pumps to cause a slow flood.
It's not messing with the vacuum cleaner.
Not at all. Instead, it acts as a highly targeted agonist, basically a chemical key that binds directly and aggressively to one specific subtype of receptor.
The 5-HT2A receptor.
Exactly. The 5-HT2A receptor.
Wait, okay. If psilocybin is just flipping a serotonin receptor, how is that functionally different from an overdose of an SSRI? Aren't they both just flooding the same system with activity?
It's a great question. It's the difference between turning on every single sprinkler in a neighborhood all at once versus firing a high-pressure fire hose directly at a single door.
Oh, okay. Wow. So the SSRI is the sprinklers.
Right. An SSRI indirectly stimulates all 14 different serotonin receptor subtypes by leaving serotonin just floating in the gap.
And psilocybin is the fire hose.
Exactly. Psilocybin largely bypasses the others and forcefully activates those 5-HT2A receptors. And those specific receptors are densely concentrated in layer 5 pyramidal neurons in the cortex.
And those neurons are important because...
Because they act as the brain's executive conductors. When psilocybin binds to them, it doesn't just gently stimulate them. It switches them wide open for about 4 to 6 hours.
Just a massive surge of activity.
A massive acute surge of cortical excitation, yes.
Now, the OOTW piece specifically mentions that this excitation disrupts the default mode network.
Yes, the default mode network, or the DMN.
Can you break down what the DMN actually is for us?
Sure. The DMN is essentially the interconnected web of brain regions responsible for our sense of ego. It handles our self-reflection and our mental time travel.
Mental time travel, like worrying about the future or agonizing over the past.
Exactly that. It is the narrator in your head. And in severely depressed patients, the DMN is often hyperconnected and extremely rigid.
Okay, so it's stuck.
It operates like a deep rut in a dirt road. Thoughts just get trapped in these negative, ruminative loops and they can't get out.
So when psilocybin hits with that intense 5-HT2A activation, what happens to that rut?
It essentially introduces a massive wave of entropy into the system. It temporarily dissolves that rigid network.
It flattens the dirt road.
Yes. Allowing disparate parts of the brain that normally never communicate to suddenly start talking to each other.
That is wild. The text also outlines a specific biological cascade that gets triggered during this window. The BDNF-TRKB-MTOR cascade.
Right, the alphabet soup.
Yeah, I don't want to skip over this just because it sounds complicated. Because if we're talking about rewiring the brain, this seems to be the actual machinery doing the rewiring.
Yeah,
right?
It is. That cascade is essentially the holy grail of neuroplasticity.
Okay, so walk us through it. What happens when that receptor is forced open?
When that 5-HT2A receptor is forced open by psilocin, it releases a surge of glutamate. And that glutamate, in turn, stimulates the release of BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
BDNF. Okay. What does it do?
Think of BDNF as high-octane fertilizer for your neurons. It binds to a receptor called TRKB. and that binding activates MTOR.
MTOR.
Right. MTOR is an enzyme that regulates cellular energy and protein synthesis. When MTOR is activated, the neuron literally begins synthesizing new proteins to build new dendritic spines.
Wait, really? It's physically building new branches.
Yes, the physical architecture of the brain is literally branching out, creating new synaptic connections in real time.
Okay, so returning to our room analogy. If the SSRI is carefully installing acoustic foam to muffle the noise over a period of 6 weeks,
right.
Psilocybin is like taking a sledgehammer and violently tearing down the walls of the room entirely.
A very apt, if slightly terrifying, comparison.
Yeah. Because for a brief, intense window of time, the entire structure is exposed to the elements. The rigidity is completely gone.
Exactly. And because of that BDNF cascade we just talked about, you have the rapid synthesis of new building materials available to completely rebuild the architecture of the room before the walls go back up.
Wow. I mean, the contrast couldn't be sharper.
It really couldn't. You have chronic, broad-spectrum dampening to achieve stability, versus an acute, localized detonation designed to induce temporary structural malleability.
So we have a chemical that soundproofs the room and a chemical that tears down the walls. But, you know, theoretical mechanisms and microscopic cascades don't really mean anything until they collide with a suffering human body.
Right. You have to test it in the real world.
Exactly. And in 2021, researchers finally forced these two biological strategies into a head-to-head collision.
And it is genuinely surprising how rare this is.
Really? Why is that?
Well, the OTW Journal points out that despite the massive cultural war between these treatments, they have been directly, rigorously compared in a head-to-head trial exactly one time.
Wait, only once? With all the billions of dollars flowing into pharmaceuticals and psychedelic startups, we have a single head-to-head showdown.
Only one rigorous direct comparison of this scale, yes.
That is insane. Okay, so let's talk about that showdown. Who ran it?
It was led by Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris and his team at Imperial College London, and it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
The NEJM.
Yeah.
That's as prestigious as it gets.
The gold standard. It was a rigorous, double-blind, randomized phase two trial involving 59 individuals. And these were people suffering from long-standing, moderate to severe depression.
Okay, but I have to stop you there. I am highly skeptical of how you actually blind this kind of study.
Yeah, it's the biggest hurdle in psychedelic research.
Because if I give someone a daily pill that they barely feel, and I give someone else a 25 milligram dose of pure psilocybin that dissolves their sense of space and time for 6 hours. I mean, blinding seems practically impossible. How did they structure the arms of this study?
They engineered a very clever double dummy design to try and get around that.
Double dummy. What does that mean?
They split the 59 patients into two groups. Group A, the psilocybin group, received two massive 25 milligram macro doses of psilocybin spaced 3 weeks apart.
Okay, the macro dose.
Right. However, to mimic the routine of the SSRI group, Group A was also sent home with capsules to take every single morning.
Ah, and those were?
Completely inert placebos, just fake pills.
So the psilocybin group gets the massive psychedelic event, plus they go through the daily ritual of swallowing a pill.
Exactly. Now, Group B, the SSRI group, was prescribed escitalopram, which is a very common, very effective daily antidepressant.
Okay, so they are taking the active drug every morning for 6 weeks.
Yes, and to ensure they also experienced the clinical ritual of a dosing day, they were brought into the exact same clinical setting as Group A and given a dose of psilocybin.
Wait, they gave the SSRI group psilocybin too?
They did, but their dose was restricted to a mere 1 milligram.
A 1 milligram dose. That's totally imperceptible, right?
Completely imperceptible. It's an active placebo.
So why even do it?
Because it allows the clinicians to look both groups in the eye and honestly say, you'll be receiving a dose of psilocybin today.
Oh, wow. That standardizes the expectation across the board.
Exactly. It attempts to level the psychological playing field. But the most critical variable in this entire trial-like, the variable that dictates how we must interpret the results, is the psychological framework itself.
Right, because both groups received identical intensive psychological support.
Yes, and this changes the entire calculus of the data.
Completely. We are not just looking at a trial of drug A versus drug B in a vacuum.
No, we are looking at a trial of psilocybin-assisted therapy versus SSRI-assisted therapy.
So what did that therapy actually look like?
Both groups underwent preparatory therapy sessions before the dosing days to set intentions and build trust. Both groups had two trained guides sitting with them in a carefully curated room for the entire six-hour duration of the dosing session.
Even the group that only got 1 milligram?
Even them.
Wow.
And both groups received integration therapy afterward to process their experiences.
Okay, so the environment was heavily standardized.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone gets the full therapeutic container. So we have 59 patients, comprehensive therapy for everyone, the dampening strategy versus the opening strategy.
The stage is set.
Right. But looking at the results documented in the OTW piece, the initial data point sounds like a massive anticlimax.
It really does on the surface.
Because the trial pre-registered its primary outcome measure, which was the QIDS-SR16 depression score. And on that specific metric, the trial was a statistical tie.
A dead heat, statistically speaking.
The psilocybin group saw their depression scores drop by about 8 points, and the escitalopram group dropped by about 6 points. And the researchers explicitly noted that a 2-point margin of error means this could just be statistical noise.
Right.
So if the two strategies tied on the pre-registered main test of the whole multi-million-dollar study, why did this trial trigger an absolute earthquake in the psychiatric community?
Well, the answer requires an understanding of how clinical trials are constrained by their own rules.
Okay, explain that.
So the QIDS-SR16 is a 16-item self-report questionnaire. It measures things like sleep disturbance, appetite changes, and general mood. In clinical science, you must publicly declare which exact yardstick you are going to use to define success before the trial even begins.
To keep people honest.
Exactly. It prevents behacking, where researchers just dig through mountains of data after the fact to find a favorable statistic and build a narrative around it.
So because they declared the QE-SR16 as the primary measure, and the results landed within the margin of error, they were legally and scientifically bound to report no significant difference on that primary outcome.
Right. The headlines could have accurately stated, psychedelics fail to beat standard antidepressants.
Wow. But they didn't. Why?
Because the QIDS-SR16 is just one narrow lens through which to view human suffering. The study also measured a vast battery of secondary outcomes.
And what happened there?
Across almost the entire spectrum of those secondary measures, the data overwhelmingly favored the psilocybin group.
Really? Like what kind of measures?
We are looking at superior overall response rates, deeper reductions in trait anxiety, vastly improved scores of general well-being, and significantly better cognitive and social functioning.
But the remission rates cited in the text, I mean, those are what really stop you in your tracks. Absolutely. The remission metric is the ultimate goal in psychiatry.
Because remission doesn't just mean you feel a little better.
Exactly. It means your symptom profile has dropped so profoundly low that you no longer qualify for a diagnosis of clinical depression. You are effectively well.
So what were the numbers?
At the 6-week mark, the remission rate for the psilocybin group was roughly 57%.
57%.
Over half. And the remission rate for the SSRI group was 28%.
Wow. Psilocybin literally doubled the rate of total remission in patients with moderate to severe depression.
It did. And that is not a marginal incremental improvement. That is an exponential leap in efficacy.
So the authors found themselves in this really nuanced scientific bind. They could not legally claim overarching superiority because of the tie on the primary measure.
Right. Their hands were tied by the pre-registration.
But that doubling of the remission rate, combined with the sweeps across all the secondary quality of life metrics, I mean, it definitively proved that the opening strategy is not merely equivalent to the dampening strategy.
It demonstrated a depth and rapidity of healing that the daily pill simply could not touch in that 6-week time frame.
Here is where this goes from an abstract statistical debate to something deeply visceral. Because we can sit here and analyze QIDS-SR16 scores and p-values until we are blue in the face.
Right, but it misses the human element.
Right, exactly. Mm. A number on a spreadsheet does not capture the phenomenology of the treatment. It doesn't tell us what it actually feels like to wake up inside a body that is actively processing these medications.
And that lived experience is often why people stay on or abandon a drug.
Right. The clinical trial data is foundational, but the OOTW piece pivots hard into the subjective lived experience of the patient. And it points out that the dampening strategy comes with a highly specific, deeply personal toll.
It does. And the physiological cost of an SSRI is the direct result of its core mechanism.
The acoustic foam.
Exactly. When you introduce a chemical that systematically downregulates the brain's reactivity, specifically to shield the patient from psychological agony, That chemical does not possess the nuance to selectively target only the bad emotions.
Right, the dampening is totally indiscriminate.
The acoustic foam absorbs the sound of a beautiful symphony just as effectively as it absorbs the sound of a screaming match.
And the lived manifestation of that indiscriminate absorption is emotional blunting.
Yes, emotional blunting. Mm-hmm. Patients frequently report a profound flattening of their entire affective landscape.
Can you give an example of what that feels like day to day?
Well, they no longer fall into the terrifying, paralyzing abyss of depression, which is obviously a massive relief.
Right, it saves their life.
But they also find themselves completely incapable of accessing transcendent joy or spontaneous excitement, or sometimes even the cathartic release of weeping at a funeral or during a sad movie. They just feel hollow.
They exist in an emotionally anesthetized middle ground.
Precisely. And the trial data captured this phenomenon explicitly.
Yeah, the text notes that the patients in the escitalopram group reported significantly higher rates of reduced emotional responsiveness compared to the psilocybin group.
It's a very common, very well-documented side effect.
And inextricably linked to that emotional blunting is the reality of sexual dysfunction.
Yes, which is a massive quality of life issue.
Because by flooding the system with serotonin and inadvertently altering dopaminergic pathways, SSRIs frequently cause severe delays in climax, total loss of libido, and sometimes literal genital numbness.
It is consistently cited as one of the primary reasons patients abandon SSRI therapy entirely.
It's just a brutal calculation.
Yeah.
They're forced to calculate this trade-off. Relief from suicidal ideation in exchange for their emotional and sexual vitality.
It's a heavy price to pay for stability.
And let's examine the phenomenology of the psilocybin group. Because if the SSRI group is paying the toll of emotional anesthesia, the opening strategy seems to deliver the exact opposite experience.
It does. The side effect profile of psilocybin therapy is characterized by intense emotional amplification.
Amplification, not dampening.
Right. Rather than flattening the affective landscape, patients reported highly charged, deeply meaning-laden experiences.
They didn't feel isolated behind a wall of neurochemical soundproofing.
No, they reported a sudden, profound sense of connection. Connection to their own repressed emotions, to the people in their lives, and often to a broader sense of existential meaning or spirituality.
The contrast is just staggering. One group feels muffled, the other group feels overwhelmingly connected to everything.
It is a radical departure from the psychiatric norm.
But, and I want to introduce a heavy dose of skepticism here, because the OOTW piece issues a massive caveat regarding how we actually interpret these self-reported feelings of connection and meaning.
Right, we have to look at the context of the trial.
Exactly. The blinding problem rears its head again.
It is the elephant in the room for all psychedelic research.
Because the source notes that blinding in psychedelic trials is practically a farce.
It really is.
Like, if I am in a trial and I take a daily escitalopram pill that maybe gives me a slight headache or some mild nausea, I might genuinely be unsure if I'm in the active group or the placebo group.
Right, the ambiguity holds.
But if I swallow 25 milligrams of psilocybin and an hour later the clinical walls are breathing, I am reliving a repressed childhood memory in 4K resolution, and I am literally sobbing while experiencing a sense of unity with the cosmos.
Yeah, you know you didn't get the placebo.
I absolutely know I didn't get the 1 milligram dummy pill.
Exactly. And that shatters the blind immediately. And the psychological phenomena of expectancy cannot be overstated here.
Expectancy? Like placebo on steroids?
Essentially, yes. These patients are not living in a vacuum. They read the exact same articles we do. They know psychedelics are being touted in the media as a miracle cure.
Right.
So when the psychoactive effects hit them with that level of intensity, their expectation of healing just skyrockets.
If I know I got the magic bullet, I am biologically primed to feel better.
Exactly. That profound subjective experience inadvertently turbocharges the placebo effect. We have to view the subjective reports through a highly analytical lens because of this.
So we can't just take the feeling of connection at face value.
The feelings of connection and meaning are authentic to the patient, definitely. But they are tangled up in the massive psychological weight of the experience itself.
It doesn't invalidate the 57% remission rate, obviously.
No, the clinical outcomes are real. But it forces us to acknowledge that the magic of the mushroom is at least partly the psychological theater of the event itself.
Which brings us to another fundamental divergence highlighted in the journal article. The difference in how these drugs feel is deeply intertwined with the logistics of how often you have to take them.
Right, the timeline of treatment.
We're moving from the biological architecture to the actual tempo of the mind.
And the temporal differences dictate entirely different lifestyle integrations for the patient.
Let's talk about the SSRI tempo first.
Well, the SSRI operates on a timeline of chronic maintenance. It requires absolute daily compliance.
I think of it as the daily commute of mental health. It is a slow, repetitive, highly durable routine.
And the timeline of that commute is frustratingly sluggish, because the efficacy relies on that slow downstream downregulation of the 5-HT1A receptors we discussed earlier.
Right. The acoustic phone takes time to install.
Exactly. An SSRI typically takes 2 to 6 weeks of daily dosing before the patient begins to register any therapeutic relief whatsoever.
So for the first month, you are just suffering.
The first month is often just enduring the side effects, nausea, fatigue, headaches, while waiting for the brain to adapt.
That's brutal. And once remission is achieved,
the standard psychiatric protocol is to maintain that daily dose for 6 months to a year, or indefinitely in many cases, just to prevent relapse.
You are totally locked into the regimen, and stopping is its own neurobiological ordeal, isn't it?
It is. The source heavily emphasizes the dangers of sudden cessation.
What happens if you just stop taking it?
Well, the brain has physically remodeled its receptor densities to accommodate the constant presence of the SSRI. If you abruptly remove the drug, the system is thrown into absolute chaos.
Withdrawal.
Yes. Patients experience severe discontinuation syndrome. We are talking dizziness, severe nausea, insomnia, and the infamous brain zaps.
Brain zaps? That sounds terrifying.
They are essentially electrical shock sensations in the head, often triggered by moving your eyes. It is highly distressing.
So the exit ramp is just as slow as the on-ramp.
It requires months of delicate, medically supervised tapering to get off safely.
Okay, now contrast that daily grueling grind with the tempo of psilocybin. The article categorizes psilocybin not as a maintenance medication, but as a discrete, acute event.
It belongs to the pharmacologic class of rapid-acting interventions. It sits alongside compounds like ketamine in that regard.
So the treatment paradigm does not involve a daily pill at all?
No, it involves one, perhaps two, highly orchestrated dosing sessions.
And the therapeutic onset, does it take 6 weeks?
Not at all. The neuroplasticity triggered by that BDNF cascade begins immediately.
The sledgehammer works fast.
Very fast. Patients frequently report massive reductions in depressive symptoms within 24 to 48 hours of the session.
A single event yields benefits that the article notes can persist for weeks, months, and sometimes up to a year without a single additional dose.
It is a totally different paradigm.
I mean, that completely shatters the chronic pharmaceutical business model, doesn't it?
It certainly challenges it. You are relying on a massive, singular biological disruption to reset the baseline, rather than relying on a continuous chemical pressure to hold the baseline in place.
The temptation here is to just declare a clear winner, to say, well, psilocybin is obviously better.
Which is what a lot of the internet does.
Right, but neither tempo is objectively better in a vacuum.
Yeah.
They are solutions for entirely different reality.
Exactly.
The SSRI is a daily supplement for the psyche. It requires discipline, it carries side effects, but it is predictable and stabilizing.
It keeps you functioning.
And psilocybin is akin to a major surgical intervention for your emotional architecture. It is rapid, it is profound, but it is a massive, exhausting undertaking.
Which segues perfectly into the grounded reality check provided in the final sections of the OOTW piece.
Yes, the reality check. Because if we pause the deep dive right here, the narrative is dangerously lopsided.
It sounds like a miracle cure.
Right. We've established that psilocybin offers rapid-acting structural neuroplasticity, double the remission rates, and emotional connection rather than sexual dysfunction and blunting. So the obvious question is, why isn't every psychiatrist on earth tearing up their escitalopram prescriptions and handing out mushrooms?
And that is where we have to read the fine print.
Let's read it. Because I keep coming back to the methodology of that 2021 trial. The researchers provided intensive specialized psychotherapy before, during, and after the dosing.
It was heavily curated.
So if that psychological container was the determining factor, we have absolutely no idea what happens when a severely depressed person just buys some psilocybin on the gray market, takes it alone in their bedroom, and stares at the ceiling, do we?
We don't have clinical trial data for that, no. But the clinical consensus strongly suggests it is a recipe for disaster.
Total disaster.
This is perhaps the most dangerous blind spot in the modern psychedelic renaissance. The drug itself is not the treatment.
Let me repeat that. The drug is not the treatment.
Exactly. The drug is merely a chemical catalyst that creates a state of extreme vulnerability and structural malleability. The treatment is the psychotherapy that occurs within that open window.
Right. The sledgehammer tears down the walls. But if you don't have an architect there to help you process the trauma that was hidden behind the drywall and help you draft a blueprint to rebuild the room, you are literally just left sitting in the rubble.
And sitting in that rubble can be highly traumatizing.
The OOTW piece highlights the severe psychological risks associated with the opening strategy, right?
It does. During the acute phase of a macrodose, patients can experience terrifying ontological shock.
Ontological shock. Like their reality breaks.
Panic attacks, severe paranoia, and the sudden resurfacing of deeply buried, unprocessed traumatic memories.
And without a trained guide to navigate that distress.
The experience can easily exacerbate the depression rather than cure it. You can end up worse off than you started.
And beyond just having a bad trip, there are hard physiological contraindications, aren't there?
Very strict ones, yes. Psilocybin is an absolute contraindication for anyone with a personal or family history of psychotic disorders, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder.
Because of the cortical excitation.
Yes. The intense cortical excitation and the disruption of the default mode network can easily trigger a full-blown manic episode or a psychotic break in susceptible individuals.
It is a powerful tool, and powerful tools are inherently dangerous if used incorrectly.
Exactly.
And mitigating that danger requires an immense amount of capital and resources.
The logistics are staggering.
You need extensive psychiatric screening. Mm-hmm. You need hours of preparatory counseling. You need two highly trained therapists to sit in a room with you for 6 to 8 hours while the drug is active. And then you need weeks of follow-up integration therapy.
It is a logistical leviathan. Which brings us to the counterweight, where the daily dampening strategy of the SSRI still definitively wins.
Right, because the SSRI completely dominates on the metrics of access, scalability, and broad spectrum safety.
We absolutely cannot allow the novelty of psychedelics to obscure the fact that SSRIs are backed by massive longitudinal safety data sets spanning decades.
Millions and millions of data points.
And their utility extends far beyond just major depressive disorder.
What else are they used for?
They are the first-line defense for a massive spectrum of pathologies. Generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, bulimia, PTSD.
It's a Swiss Army knife. And let's talk about the logistics of access, because if I am suffering from debilitating, paralyzing depression, I don't necessarily have the energy to join a months-long wait list for a specialized clinic, right?
No, you need help today.
And I definitely don't have thousands of dollars to pay out of pocket for a guided 8-hour session.
But with an SSRI, you can walk into a standard primary care clinic, have a 20-minute consultation, and walk out with a prescription that costs maybe a few dollars a month.
They are legal, they are cheap, and their safety profile is so well characterized that they can be taken at home, entirely unsupervised.
Without the risk of inducing a psychotic break.
Exactly. For millions of people lacking the resources, the time, or the psychological stability for a psychedelic intervention. That accessibility is the literal difference between life and death.
A rigorous comparison demands we honor the life-saving utility of that accessibility.
So what does this all actually mean? When we zoom out and survey the entire landscape painted by the OOTW Journal, the definitive takeaway is that this is not a zero-sum game.
It is not a tidal fight where one molecule knocks out the other.
Right. They are fundamentally different instruments. The SSRI is an instrument of stability. It gently, chronically turns down the gain on distress over weeks, providing accessible, reliable relief, even if the toll is a degree of emotional anesthesia.
And psilocybin is an instrument of disruption. It aggressively flips the 5-HT2A receptor to force open a brief, explosive window of structural plasticity.
Relying entirely on a heavy, guided therapeutic container to forge meaning out of that chaos.
The paradigm shift here requires us to change the questions we are asking.
Like the journal article emphasizes, asking which drug is better is just a scientifically illiterate question.
It really is. The only valid questions are, which strategy is better for the specific patient? Under what specific clinical conditions? And at what physiological and financial cost?
Determining the answers to those questions is the complex job of a qualified medical professional, not a Reddit thread.
Definitely not a Reddit thread. And it is imperative to reiterate, the manipulation of these neurotransmitter systems is delicate.
Extremely delicate.
No one listening should ever initiate or abruptly terminate these medications without strict medical supervision.
Always consult your clinician before altering your neurochemistry. But before we close out this deep dive, There is one final, highly provocative thread buried deep in the pharmacological fine print of this source material.
Oh, this is the part that keeps researchers up at night.
We haven't pulled on it yet, but it has massive, unsettling implications for the future of mental health treatment.
It is the ultimate neurobiological catch-22.
The text details how chronic use of an SSRI physically remodels the brain by downregulating specific receptors. We discussed the 5-HT1A receptors earlier, right?
Indeed, yes.
But the daily flood of serotonin from the SSRI also causes the downregulation, the physical desensitization of the 5-HT2A receptors.
The exact same 5-HT2A receptors that psilocybin must bind to in order to trigger the BDNF cascade and the psychedelic effect.
Wait, so the source explicitly states that chronic SSRI use physically blunts the efficacy of a psychedelic?
Yes. The physiological adaptation to the daily treatment actively neutralizes the mechanism of the acute treatment.
Which poses a massive generation-defining question.
It really does.
If our current universally prescribed first-line treatment physically desensitizes the exact neurological hardware required for psychedelic therapy, what happens next?
Right. We have millions of people currently taking daily SSRIs.
If those individuals eventually decide they want to transition to psilocybin therapy, will the psilocybin even work?
The data suggests the subjective effects will be significantly muted, at least initially.
Or have our current daily tools inadvertently locked the exact neurological door that the next generation of rapid-acting treatments is trying to open?
That is a fear.
And we layered so much acoustic foam onto the walls of the room that the sledgehammer simply bounces off.
It is a profound biological puzzle, and researchers are racing to solve it as we speak.
The implications for treatment sequencing and determining safe washout periods, that is going to define the next decade of psychiatric research.
Without a doubt. It is a frontier.
It is a profound frontier. Thank you for joining us on this exploration today. Keep interrogating the hype, keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.